Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Els, close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
And we're both here, live.
And in living sound.
Living sound.
Yes, and you can tell us apart.
By the color of our shirts.
Beards.
And beards.
Yes.
Yes, his beard is plain and mine is plaid. No, wait, that's our shirts.
Well, we could get easily confused here, you know. My microphone seems to be just a little hot, so I'm burning my lips here, so if you turn it down just a little, that's much better. Okay. Anyway, let's see, what have we got to say? We got to say that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio presentation, see how I lapsed into my radio voice there for a moment, it is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. We've been researching for many years to determine if that is coincidence or if there is a causal effect, and concluded that there is a causal effect between those two issues.
I think that we need to suspend the conclusion until we get another couple of federal grants into the study, because like all great scientific research, it's not true unless you've spent a lot of money on it.
Wait a minute. All the grants we get from the federal government are negative.
That's right. Yeah, every quarter we send in a negative grant.
We send grants to the federal government. The other thing is, of course, every time they come out with a new regulation, we pay for it.
Yes.
So that's, you know, that's cool. But, you know, it's all right. I mean, that's part of the cost of doing business.
Stimulating the lack of economy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And that's fun. Anyway, so that was our disclosure. Nothing we say on this radio program should be considered to be investment advice, because it isn't. It's just commentary, and you should consult with an individual investment advisor. Notice I did not say financial advisor. And nothing we say on this radio program should be construed as legal or tax advice.
Oh, yeah, all of that. Basically what we're saying in
don't listen to anything we're saying.
facetious way is that we are intending to educate and inform you, but there's no way we can give you specific advice because we don't know exactly which one of you we're talking to at any given moment. Maybe there's only one listener, and that would be...
Well, it could be...
If you call in the one listener, maybe we could give specific advice, but I don't think so.
Could be we're just talking to each other, too. Okay, so what's going on in the world today?
Well, let's give the phone numbers before we get on.
The phone number.
There are a lot of numbers in this phone number. The phone number, if you would like to join our conversation, is 254-773-1400.
Yes.
All right. So what has happened this week?
The stock market went down just a little bit. Well, some of it did.
Which parts? Well, the parts that went down.
Yeah. And let's see. What else happened this week? The Commerce Department announced that, and I love the way they do this, the adjusted gross domestic product estimate for the third quarter on an annualized basis grew at 2.9%.
If you can get through the first part of the announcement to the number, then you probably know what the number means. And if you can't, what it means is that we grew at a higher rate than most people expected.
Yes. And we grew at a rate that will probably bump the total year's gross domestic product growth for 2016 up to pretty much what it has been the past several years. So basically it's because what we had is negative economic growth. I love that. Negative economic growth. In the first quarter, we had anemic economic growth. In the second quarter and in the third quarter, we got almost 3%.
And for those of you that have been listening to us for very long, you know that when we use the economist jargon, negative growth, what we really mean is shrinkage. But that is not the technical or academic term.
Decline.
Decline. What we have right now, what has just been announced, is growth, and growth at a high rate, or at least higher rate. It's a rate that is a decent rate even in the 80s and the 90s. That would be considered a good rate of growth.
I like the Wall Street Journal headline. U.S. economy roars back, grew 2.9% in third quarter.
What you'll like even more is last week on Friday. So this week on Friday, they say U.S. economy roars back. Mm-hmm. Last week on Friday, they had a big front page story. And front page is relative these days because the page is generally a computer screen, but it was why the economy doesn't roar anymore.
Mm, well, it just did.
I wonder if it's the same person that wrote this headline both
probably,
weeks.
Probably, because roar implies something dramatic has happened when really not much of anything happened.
Right. What we're talking about here in the GDP, a big chunk of that GDP growth was exports.
Mm-hmm. And one item.
Well, one item had the largest growth
right.
in that, and that was soybean exports.
That's right. So thank God for soybean exports.
Right. That isn't the, I mean, when it comes down to exports as a percentage of the GDP, we're talking about 0.1% of that 2.9% growth.
Actually 0.83, but you're really close.
Right. Well, I rounded it. I'm sorry about that. I figure the 0.83 would be a little bit much. So,
well, but I'm trying to be nitpicky.
0.1% of the GDP
right.
growth.
Right.
Not of the total GDP, just that 2.9% growth.
Yeah.
And what that says is that it was a big deal.
Well,
because
actually,
soybeans don't generally have any impact on the GDP.
Actually, it would have been without the 0.83, it would have been 2.07, so that's almost 1% of the 3%.
No.
It's almost a third of the 3%.
No.
Okay.
Well, we could argue about that another time when it's not
all right,
technical.
Good.
It's
okay.
It's as a 0.1% of that 2.9%. So
okay.
It's not as a percentage of it. Then I realize we're getting really technical, and you can hear our pocket protectors working against the ink stains on our shirts. But the reality is that you guys need people like us to watch the economy to tell you what's really going on. If you didn't have it, then it would be all by your gut. And that works for a while, and then it doesn't, and there's no warning when it stops working. So why are we talking about soybeans? Just like we spoke over the last almost 6-7 years now about the real reason for the Arab Spring being wheat prices. The real reason why Libya and Egypt and all of North Africa basically was destabilized and governments changed was because wheat prices went up. We're experiencing some very strange shifting in food prices right now across the world. Soybean prices are very high because there are places that generally grow it that have had horrible seasons for growing. Milk prices are extremely low. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
Milk prices? All of it is based on normal events that are semi-predictable, and generally when they come out, people are shocked by them. The soybean export numbers have been available way before the Commerce Department came out and said they affected GDP. When we have been talking to you about this, in fact, just 4 weeks ago, I was talking about expect to see soybean prices rising dramatically, expect it to be a bigger profit market for the United States. But there's a danger if you're a farmer and listening to this program. It sounds like soybeans are a great place to invest. This is a truism that is important to understand. The crop or the asset class in the market that's up right now is generally the last place you want to invest. If you're a farmer and you're thinking about growing soybeans because the price of soybeans just went up, what you're going to discover is that a lot of other people are doing it at the same time, and when your crop comes to market, the price is going to drop because everybody else's is too. So keep that in mind when people tell you the next hot thing is the hot thing that's happening right now. It's not. The next hot thing, people really knew, they wouldn't tell you about it. So that's just a side note, and most farmers are aware of that because they've been burned too many times. And there's some other issues there, but I wanted to hit that. The GDP growth of the United States is something that you and I, Old Baldy, have been talking about recovering since the end of the recession, when we've said that expect it to be a really long recovery and expect the employment to only start catching up with what we expected in the past late in the game. Well, we're starting to see that. And when we start to see that, and this is another great one. U.S. consumer confidence slid in the middle of this, but employment costs rose.
And it did, but there's a really good reason that employment costs rose, and the as you hire new people and you train them, and you promote the other people because there's a shortage of people to hire because we're getting towards full employment, then the nature of employment costs rise a little bit. And if you just have more people in the business, then
right.
employment costs rise. And they're untrained people, so it takes about a year for those people to come up to speed where they lower employment costs.
Okay, so we've just said three numbers there. We've got unemployment rates down, employment costs rising, and we have there's two more numbers to talk about. One is consumer confidence and one is consumer spending. What we're seeing here with the employment costs rising is people are getting hired. People are getting paid. That money, those costs to the business are going directly back into the economy. What's been going on since the Great Recession is that employers have been sitting on money so that eventually when they do start hiring, they don't have to lay off immediately if they hit a bump in the road. They used to go back to the bank and say, hey, I need a short-term loan. That doesn't work right now. So they've been sitting on money. When employment costs go up, we see consumer spending go up at the same time because those costs mean that the people are hiring new people or giving raises. What we've seen most recently, again, is that income levels are up across the board. That's really cool. That's something we've been waiting to happen for a long time. The Democrats and the Republicans have been screaming that it's an uneven return. We've been saying that political action on the economy should be done only in cases where there's a serious violation that has no rule against it. When we're talking about unemployment stuff, you know, every president runs on the concept of jobs. But the president doesn't get to hire very many people. That's kind of not part of the job of president. I guess if you're running on jobs, what it really is that you're running for your own job as president. That concept of the president's going to make jobs better, anybody that's studied economics or any of the old school Republicans or even yellow dog Democrats will look back and say, no, it's businesses that cause jobs, not the president. And if you make it easier on businesses or you just allow businesses to recover in their normal way without giving them money out of the blue or taking money away from them out of the blue, then the economy will recover because we're all in this to make a profit. And having said that, there's a dichotomy I want to throw out here. And dichotomy is one of those funny words. It means to comfortably hold two completely opposing ideas in your mind at the same time. So an example of that could be from a religious standpoint, somebody that goes to church and then immediately goes out to a girly bar. It's like, okay, there may be nothing wrong with going to a girly bar. It is completely legal. But then to go from church to the girly bar may not be what most people would find normal. So the dichotomy in the market, in the economy that I'm seeing here is that yesterday Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla, the major stockholder in SolarCity, announced a new kind of solar panel, or at least new for them. There are other people that have tried it and not done well. Did you catch this? Did you see the headline?
Yes, I did.
He came out and said, this is beautiful. People will put it on. It's basically shingles, beautiful shingles that are solar panels. And they absorb the sunlight and create energy. And same newspaper, one column over to the right, headline, Exxon lowers its estimate on its reserves. Its estimate on its reserves, that's not cash reserves, it's oil reserves. They're looking at the oil sands in Canada and saying, it's really expensive to get that out of the ground right now. It's the same expense as normal, but we can't make a profit on it because the oil prices are so far down. Why is this a dichotomy? Because solar as a function right now is much, much more expensive than petroleum products for creating energy. It's coming down in cost, but very slowly. And a big chunk of the reason why it's competitive across the board with petroleum products is because it's being subsidized. When you put solar panels on your roof or in your yard, you get a big tax credit, which means that you can have a choice to send a dollar to the IRS or send a dollar to a solar panel. If you already have an expense, it makes the cost go way down when you're talking about tax credits. So if you're going to pay the IRS or pay for your own power, you might as well do it that way. It still only makes it competitive with the power grid, and that's only if the solar panels don't break. So why am I dwelling on this? This is an example where politics encroaches on the market. One of the best things that could happen for renewable energy is for the price of oil to go back up. Instead, we're causing the price of the solar panel to go down with taxpayer money. When we look around and we say taxes are too high, and I don't know anybody that says taxes are too low, although some Democrats say they're too low on other people, not on me, but on those people over there, and some Republicans say they're too high on everybody.
Warren Buffett.
Right, and he said it's too high on me.
He said it's too low on him.
Oh, yeah, too low on him and too high on his secretary.
Right.
His secretary makes $350,000 a year, by the way, just as a side note. So that secretary is considered rich by most of the tax code.
But his point was that he paid lower, as a percentage of his income, he paid a lower percentage of taxes than she did.
Right. So there are a few people that say lower the taxes on other people and raise it on me. Not very many. While that's going on, the revenue is being spent on subsidies for solar, which is great if you're thinking long-term climate change, that sort of thing. But as a function of the economy, it's inefficient. It's a mandated thing that doesn't adjust with the cost of the petroleum world. So right now, Solar City's struggling. But it won't struggle for long if the subsidies are still there because government says they're going to increase it. So that dichotomy exists. The reality is, though, that the millennials, as a vast majority in the millennial generation, believe that climate change is a major and true threat. And they're believing science here.
Well, there's another factor here I think is usually left out of the conversation, and that is the government provides tremendous subsidies to the oil and gas industry, but they're not anywhere near as obvious as they are to, for example, solar. For example, oil and gas travel by railroad and highway, both of which the railroads obviously are privately owned, but the land was given to the railroads to put the railroads down. Highways are maintained by the public funds. Yes, there are taxes that are paid here and there, but the bottom line to it is, it's kind of like to say airline companies do not have to come in and build airports. So there's a subsidy to the airlines. There's subsidies everywhere. Now, the subsidies to the solar industry are very obvious because we can't give them free highways and free other things. So we make a big deal out of it.
There are higher subsidies. Yes. As a percentage of the cost, it's much higher on solar.
Yes, it is.
And the subsidies on oil, depending on the oil company, some of those subsidies disappear at different times kind of shockingly and can put oil companies, little ones, out of business really quickly. So the concepts here are when the government gets involved and says we need to be energy independent, I think we can all agree here, yes, the United States needs to be energy independent. That's a really good idea.
It's kind of like farms. We need to be food independent.
Right. Food independent, energy independent. And that way we're not dependent on the Middle East. Okay. Now we've put the money where the mouth is. We have subsidized both oil and solar. But it means that the competition between American companies is no longer even. And I think that is not the intent that government had. And this is where complexity comes in when we're talking about what is free trade. what does it mean? We've all agreed we want to be energy independent. And I don't believe, I mean, both major political candidates right now, Trump and Clinton, agree we should be energy independent. They've both said that completely separately. Of course, if you told either one of them that the other one had said it, they might change their opinion immediately. But the concept here is that we as America agree we should be energy independent and food independent. But there is tremendous waste in the middle of it. And the government is not as fast as the market in changing the prices on the subsidies. So keep that in mind. I've heard a lot of people talking about Elon Musk as a brilliant man. He is. But he's also in an area where one of the major reasons that the profit is there for his car company, Tesla, is because of subsidies. And the subsidies aren't enough for Solar City. They've been losing money for a year. Keep that in mind. He may be able to come around and say the design of the panels is going to make things better, but as a general rule, if you're already losing money, doubling down on it may not work. Keep that in mind. All right, you have some things to talk about?
Yep. Let's talk about the economy just a little bit. Now, okay. There's a couple of things going on here. First off, if you're an investor and you have stocks or you have an investment portfolio, your return over the last 2 years has almost certainly been flat to negative. And that's kind of the pitch. As a matter of fact, when we write the newsletter, we note the actual return of the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index from last May of 2015 May, and right now it's a negative number. And that's really the pits. We're going through a period of time when we've gone through 5 quarters, and this one probably is the end. This probably will reverse it, this meaning the third quarter, because we don't have all the data in from the third quarter yet, but it looks like it's going to reverse this. But prior to that, we went through 5 quarters of declining corporate earnings. Now, declining corporate earnings on average in the S&P 500 mean normally recession. And this is, I guess, one of the amazing things, at least to me, is that we did not have a recession. Yes, in the first quarter of this year, we had, as the economists say, negative growth or a decline, or if we got 3 of those in a row, that would be a recession. But we didn't see an increase in unemployment. We didn't see a major fall off in hiring. We didn't see industrial activity slow down. Matter of fact, it speeded up. We have seen consumer spending growing very nicely. And all this while corporations' earnings are falling. Now, that's if you follow this kind of thing, and it also, this has an impact on the stock market. It has a big impact on the stock market. But this is the amazing thing. A, we haven't had a bear market, despite the fact that earnings keep falling. B, we haven't had a recession, despite the fact that corporate earnings have fallen. So why didn't we? And the answer is, if you pull out oil and gas from the entire equation, everything's growing. And what we went through is a boom and a bust of pretty significant, I mean, when you think about the fact that the price of oil fell about 60 or 70% and is now rebounded up to about 40% of where it was, 35 or 40% of where it was, and everybody seems to be happy with $50. If we can have $50 a barrel oil, they seem to be perfectly happy. But remember, it was 120. And the fact that our economy did not collapse and a lot of other things didn't happen. In the past, by the way, an oil bust of that significance in the history of the United States economy would have produced a recession. It didn't this time.
Right in the middle of that, we've got industrial production.
We do have industrial production.
Right. And the industrial production outlook, industrial production, it's a capacity utilization. These are big words for what's going on in the United States industrially.
I like to utilize my capacity.
Yes. I don't utilize mine enough. I think my capacity is underutilized.
I don't think so. I think you're running at about 110% and I'm running at about 80, but go ahead.
Well, you've just defined something. They measure that growth in industrial utilization and industrial growth, so new products coming out. So capacity is measured. If you're at 100%, then you're going to break things. We're at about 75% of capacity in our industrial area, and we're putting out a great deal of goods and services, and the Made in USA logo is picking up big time. And the numbers that we were quoting earlier about exports are referenced here. The growth in exports had that number that you quoted as 0.83. I should have been saying 0.01 for soybeans. The 0.83 is all exports added to the GDP. That's not just soybeans. That's the whole thing. And our industrial output grew at the same time. So our industrial output in the United States is growing right now. The area that it's growing the most is very interesting, Mr. Spock.
Yes.
Fascinating.
Actually, Captain. He says interesting.
Interesting, Captain. Fascinating.
To the point where James Tiberius Kirk on one occasion turned to him and pointed at him and said, "Do not say interesting."
Right. So when a number on this index is 100, it means that we're at the same level as we were the month before. Anything above 100 is growth. Anything below it.
You sure it's not 50?
This is a different index.
Oh, different index. Okay.
So where we are right now is we're at a 104.2.
Cool.
So there's it looks like a 4% growth rate in our industrial performance in the United States. The area that it's the highest, though, is in construction. And anybody that's been around construction lately can see it. It's everywhere.
Particularly in Salado.
Yeah, particularly. And all over the road. It's everywhere. Construction is at 109. We're getting a 9% growth rate in construction based on where we were a year ago. That is tremendous. That's a telling point. It's part of the reason why our GDP is rising, is our ability to construct things is coming back online. We stopped for a long time. People weren't buying houses. Household formation is up. And the majority of new households are purchases, not renters. That is huge. That is one of those numbers that we've been talking about for a long time, and I know people get bored when we really get into the nitty-gritty. In order to grow as a nation, our youngest generation needs to get out of their parents' house, and they've been waiting to do that for a long time.
And they also need to get out of rental apartments.
And out of rental apartments, because long-term, that is not a growth-oriented area. Now, if you own the rental unit, it's been very growth-oriented for you. For the people that are living there, they're moving backwards, not forwards. The money that they spend disappears. They have nothing left over. What I have said, and you have said for many years, is that when you buy a house, you shouldn't expect a huge profit at the end. It may look like a profit, but it basically keeps up with the property taxes and inflation. If you look at the expenses associated with owning the house and the property taxes, you have what you started with. But renters don't even have that. Renters don't have, in fact, they have a lot less than they started with. They had the ability to live somewhere, but when they leave, they have nothing left over. And long term, that means that more people owning is better. Now, let's not go too far and say everybody should own. You got to earn it. That's what led to one of the bubble and busts of vast proportions lately. You got to earn the ability to own. But it's happening. The millennial generation has got the highest saving rates.
Yeah,
except for people above the age of 70.
The whole savings rate in the economy right now, by the way, and I don't know if you remember, I'm not trying to derail what you're saying, but this is a crucial item that ties into what you're saying and what I'm going to say about it in a minute. You may remember back in the 1990s and again in 2006, the savings rate in the United States went negative.
Right.
In other words, people are actually taking on they're buying more things than they were earning money
right.
to buy.
5.7%
Yeah,
now.
5.7, 5.8, yeah. And the point is, we are at a high savings rate in the United States today. And what we're seeing is people's income going up. Historically, what is it, it's rising by a couple of percent. The average hourly worker's getting about a 2% above inflation raise each year. In some quarters, it runs up to 3%. So we would expect to see, historically, if those consumers went out and spent that extra 3% of money, we would, since 70% of our economy is typically consumer spending things, we would expect to see a 3% growth in the economy because other things are growing too. But they're not doing it. What they're doing is they're paying off debts, debts in many cases.
Except that we just saw this last quarter a 2.9%.
Yeah, right.
So this is what we've been talking about. Once we reach that saturation, once you feel like your debts are paid down enough, once you feel like your payment is coming in, you're getting raises again, you can start spending.
And here's the good news. And it's bad news, it's good news, as we usually say. Last quarter, the percentage of households that owned or basically had mortgages on, most cases, the home in which they lived was 62.9%. This quarter, it's 63.5%. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot, a 4% jump, but in one quarter, that's not annualized either. This is the real percentage. What's happened is, and the people who are buying the house are in their 30s, not 50s and 60s, as we've seen in the past. So what we're actually seeing is, by the way, the 62.9% is the lowest it's been since the 1960s.
Yeah.
Now,
here's a 54-year low.
This is the good news. When you got that many people out there who are living in apartments or living with their parents or whatever, who have paid down their debts to the degree that we're seeing that happen, and they come back in, and that's what we're seeing right now, starting to buy houses. We see younger families, the average age of these new house purchases is starting downward. We can reasonably expect to see a construction boom in the next several years, barring some disaster of some kind.
And that comes to where I was planning on going all the way up to now. We've got some commercials to play, and what it says is that no matter who is elected, the economy is going to most likely be booming in the next couple of years.
I'm glad you put most likely in there, because my compliance officer would not allow me to say going without putting something in
it's
there.
It's most likely. And now, does that mean we're not going to have a recession in the next 4 years? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It's quite likely that we'll have a recession stuck in the middle in there, because just looking at history, we've gone a long time since the Great Recession. We went a long time after the Depression without a recession.
And I want to talk about that.
So it's likely that we'll have a recession in here, but it's also extremely likely that we're going to have a really good boom leading up to it. Just don't get overexcited when the boom is going. Keep that in mind now. Write it down for yourself. If we see this boom,
let's
play some commercials.
Let's play some comicals. Let's stimulate the economy, okay?
So we'll be back on the other side of this with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have a telephone in here. It doesn't get used very often, but it is here. The phone number is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Now, if we're starring, who's the supporting cast?
The question is, are we shooting stars, though? Because they've kind of fallen to earth.
Is nobody in here?
Nobody's not present.
Nobody is present.
Other than the
stars.
Right.
Of this particular program. Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number is to call if you'd like to join with us or comment or object to anything we have said or not said, as the case may be under some circumstances. You may give us a call at 254-773-1400, and we will attempt to answer your telephone call, depending upon the efficacy of the equipment in the room. Let's see. We were talking about the economy roaring back at 2.9%, which is very, very good. But we also talked about the probability of a recession in the next 4 years. Will the next president face a recession? This is the odd thing. It's kind of like flipping a coin. If you flip a coin 5 times and you're not Jake, because Jake can control his coin flipping very accurately, If you flip a coin five times and you get heads, what are the percentage probabilities on your next flip that you will get heads?
50-50.
Yeah, well, it turns out that if you actually study very carefully the statistics of recessions, you have exactly the same percentage chance each year of getting a recession, no matter how much expansion has gone on before it. Now, there's some things that can influence. For example, if we've had unusually high growth in the past couple of years, the probability of a recession goes up. And we have a caller on 773-1400. By the way, the probability is 23%.
I think over the next 5 years, it gets closer to like 80%.
Well, that's what the study said. It said that the probability in any 1 year is 23%, no matter what year it is, no matter how many years of expansion you've had
in
before.
In any 1 year, that's correct.
Okay, so what we have is a caller on 773-1400, and you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
The poor, hardworking immigrant again. And what is a flattening of a yield curve? That's the first question.
Ooh, yes. Yeah.
The second question is, what is the P.E. ratio of a stock? Can I compare it to a standard, for example, S&P P.E. ratio? I mean, what does it mean?
Okay. Can you stay on the line just to make sure that we get this answered correctly for you?
I can, so but I don't need to. But okay. If you want me to, I'll stay online.
Okay. So you asked, what's the flattening of a yield curve? We'll start with that one.
That's when there's not enough air in the tire.
No, that's the wrong kind of curve.
Wrong kind of curve. Okay, sorry.
Oh, gee.
Oh, yes. All right. Yield curve, if you think of different lengths of time. So if you think, I need a, you go to a friend and you say, can I borrow $5 and I'll give it back to you in a day. That's a very, very, very short-term loan. And short-term loans tend to have very low interest rates, particularly if you're borrowing from a friend. They just give you the $5 and you give it back to them.
And right now, the interest rates on short-term loans are pretty close to zero.
Right, just like you're borrowing from a friend, basically. So long-term rates, well, your friend kind of wants to use that money. So they're going to charge you to use the money if you want the money for 30 years.
I've got some people I learned five.
Or 70 years.
Yeah, well, 70, we don't have a lot of those.
Or Apple just did a 100-year bond. So, yeah. I mean, there's some really, really long stuff out there. What tends to happen is the longer the loan, and this is a tendency because it can get really screwy when interest rates change. The longer the time period of the loan, the higher the interest rate, usually. Okay. When that flattens, what they're talking about, and sometimes if in the middle of it, if you have a 20-year loan and you get a change in interest rate, so you can have the 20-year loan be higher than the 30-year loan. So you can actually, if you plot a curve from zero at the very short term up to 20 and then down to 30, there's a curve there. Usually the 30 is higher, but 30 means, by definition, sometimes the loan was given a few years back and hasn't adjusted its interest rate.
Actually, if you plot it out on a graph, it's called a yield curve because it tends to rise more at the front end and less at the back end. So it looks kind of like a curve, but it rises. When short-term interest rates rise but long-term interest rates don't, or when long-term interest rates fall and short-terms don't fall too, then you have a smaller difference between 30-year bonds and, let's say, 2-year bonds, and that's called a flattening of the yield curve.
Yeah, the basically it's a straighter line rather than a curve.
Yeah, and if it's steep, where you have really low interest rates on the front end and the long are really high, that's called a steep yield curve and generally indicates a rapidly growing economy.
The reason why it indicates that is because people are borrowing money. That's the only reason that long-term rates can go up is there's a lot of people trying to get the money. So the people making the loans can charge more for them. It's the same as if you have a hotel and you have 3 rooms. It's a very small hotel. You have 3 rooms in the hotel and 2 of them are booked up and 3 people show up for the last hotel. You may not raise your rate that night, but you may, if it's a regular occurrence, decide to bring your rates up. Mm-hmm. That's a supply and demand, and when people are borrowing long-term money at a high rate, then those rates go up really fast.
And that's the – it's a perception thing by the people who are borrowing the money. For example, if right now you concluded that to buy a house you were willing not to pay 3% or 3.25 or whatever as a 30-year mortgage, but you thought a 7% 30-year mortgage was a good deal. No, seriously.
Right.
What you were saying is, I think this house is really going to appreciate in value over the next 30 years, so I'm willing to pay 7% in order to borrow the money to buy the house. That would indicate that you're very optimistic about the long-term economy, and you're along with a lot of other people, want to make a lot of long-term investments. That stimulates the economy. And if you say, okay, short-term rates at the bank are 1% or less, but I'm only willing to pay 3% to borrow money for 30 years, that indicates the economy is pretty depressed.
Right.
And that's where we are right now.
So then your second question, did that answer that first off? Did you understand?
Yes, it did.
Okay, the second question was, what is the P.E. ratio? What does it mean? And again, this is one that's easier to look at real property to understand. If you bought a house for $100,000, and you decided to rent it out rather than live in it, and someone's rent over a full year was $10,000. That's not generally how rent is set up. They say by month. But if it's $10,000, the income on that property is $10,000. That would be the earnings. The price on that property is $100,000. So the price divided by the earnings is the price-to-earnings ratio.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 10. It means that in 10 years, the income on that property would pay you back the value on the property, and you could still sell it for the same value.
Let me make a minor adjustment to that. If the net income after expenses,
right.
not counting loan payments,
oversimplified,
is $10,000. In other words, you clear $10,000 of profit, taxable profit, on that house, and you paid $100,000 for it, well, then you have a P.E. ratio of 10,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is a good one for real estate.
Yeah, that's when you're looking at growth-oriented stocks, a lot of times their price-to-earnings ratio are really high because people expect them to have higher earnings in the future rather than what they have right now. That's why they're called growth. They expect growth in earnings.
Mm-hmm.
Other positions that tend to keep a pretty flat or steady, slow growth in earnings tend to have a much lower price-to-earnings ratio because you don't expect it to jump up. Now, when you see a place or a company that has zero or very low earnings and their price-to-earnings ratio is like 50, that's one of those things where without a lot of research, I can look at it and say that's probably not a good place to be.
And this is the thing about price-to-earnings ratio. There's at least three different ways of commonly used ways of stating the price-to-earnings
ratio
of corporations.
Dozens of ways and three commonly used ways.
So there's not a real – for instance, I could go and do the research and tell you that the price-to-earnings ratio on the Standard Poor's 500 stock index, and I could give you three very different numbers that are very commonly reported in the papers, and they don't bother to tell you which one they're reporting.
Right. The idea is to compare apples to apples and keep using the same one if you're going to use one of them.
We find the forward P.E. ratio to be the most accurate because what happens is if you take all the analysts out there and their consensus is that this company will have this much profit over the next year, inevitably, recently at least, since 2000, that number has been artificially low. In other words, they actually are going to have more profit than that. So if you take the next year's profits.
Right, just a second.
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
You said forward PE. Is it different than PE itself?
Yes.
Yes.
Standard PE ratio is the earnings during the past year.
Okay.
Forward PE ratio is the estimated earnings in the next year.
And then there's the Shiller price-to-earnings ratio, which is the last 10 years or 30 years.
You're talking like an economist now, you know.
We are.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
But the point is, if you see PE ratio in the paper or in some publication and they don't detail what they're saying, it's generally because the reporter doesn't know which PE ratio he's reporting on.
So let's go back to that house concept. The $100,000 house, you've got a renter in it right now that's going to pay you $10,000. But you have a conversation with your renter and you say, I'm going to have to raise rates next year. And the renter says, okay, I don't like it, but I can afford it. Now it's going to be $11,000.
Mm-hmm.
the forward-looking price-to-earnings ratio suddenly becomes more accurate because you can be more predictive. Mm-hmm. If that renter stays and they've committed to and they are okay with a higher rent, then that price-to-earnings ratio is going to go up. But if you're measuring it based on the last 12 months, it hasn't changed at all.
Now the price-to-earnings ratio actually goes down.
Oh, yeah, down for and, more
and
income,
so
yes.
It's a complicated issue. And the other thing, comparing it with rental property is a really good way to understand it.
But it's oversimplified.
And the reason, but there's a difference, and this is the big difference, and this is what makes it complicated. If I buy a given piece of rental property economically and every other way, over the next 30 years, it's going to depreciate. It's going to lose value.
Unless you repair it a lot.
Well, even if you repair it a lot, it might hold its value. But an older house is worth less than a newer house, generally speaking.
Right.
A good, healthy corporation
can be a new corporation every year.
Right. We expect that it will be worth more in 10 years or 30 years than it's worth today.
We certainly hope so anyway.
So the P.E. ratio on the S&P 500 is somewhere, depending on which one you look at, between 17 and 20.
Right.
Okay.
And so you say, goodness gracious, I wouldn't buy a house and only get a roughly 5% return on it. But if you think about the current interest rate environment that we're in today, which is nothing,
yeah,
basically.
Zero to nothing.
And the best way to look at it, at least according to his history and according to economists, if you're a long-term investor, is to simply say, okay, a house, a stock or the whole stock market is probably going to be worth more 10 years from now than it is now. About 90% of the 10-year periods, it's worth more, okay? So would you take a 5% interest rate, if you invested your money and you're going to leave it there for 10 years, would you accept a 5% interest rate as a reasonable return?
I think a lot of people in CDs would say, yes, I would, but there's a risk involved. That house may be worth less in 10 years.
But the issue then is you turn around and look at a treasury bill, which definitely will not be worth if you have a 10-year treasury note. And right now a 10-year treasury note is paying about 1.85%. And basically, if you have a choice, because the stock market in 10 years paying you back and not having a loss is a near certainty, not perfect certainty, but it's a near certainty. And as a result, if you're willing to leave your money for 10 years,
well diversified,
like in a major across the market, getting a 5% probable return over the next 10 years generally is a good idea, but people don't see it that way because they're scared.
Right.
Does that make sense to you?
Did that help?
A little bit.
We've made it even more confusing.
Yeah, I'm less confused than I was before.
Okay, so the current P.E. ratio on the S&P 500 stock index is the equivalent of a 5% return right now on earnings.
So if there is a stock that says it's paying 35 P.E. ratio, or there is a stock that says it's paying...
No, not paying. Don't say paying.
Yeah, 5 P.E. ratio compared to S&P average of 18 or 17 or whatever it is. What does that mean for the stock?
It doesn't mean anything unless you look at the company.
Right. And if you look at, for instance, a really growth-oriented company, they're going to have a higher P.E. ratio because their earnings right now don't really represent what's going on today. What they're being valued on is what the investor hopes is going to happen later on. We're about out of time for this hour, and we can continue talking about this hour.
This whole book's been written on this, by the way.
And thank you very much for helping this poor, unappreciated, hardworking immigrant.
I appreciate you, let me tell you.
And let me tell you that we are all descendant from poor, hardworking immigrants, and some of us are still poor and hardworking.
You have a good day, sir. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. If you would like to contact us off the air, we do give advice to people generally of high net worth. The phone number to reach there, we've got voicemail waiting locally, is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free from anywhere, 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email us directly
at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com.
And if you would like to drop us an email there, we really do use that for our program planning. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEN.